Hey Caffeinators, welcome to the Vet Tech Cafe. The Vet Tech Cafe is a podcast centered around veterinary technicians and nurses, hosted by myself, Dave Cowan, and my good friend Jeff Backus. We strive to discuss current issues facing our profession and give our colleagues a voice and a medium to enter into these discussions. Our guests are experts in the veterinary field that we hope can help our listeners work towards dealing with these issues, as well as coming up with solutions that can lead to change. If you have a question, comment, or would like to be a guest on the Vet Tech Cafe, please contact us at vettechcafe@gmail.com, or you can find us at our website, vettechcafe.com. One thing we would ask of you, our listeners, is to rate and review us on whatever podcast platform you're listening to. We're not exactly sure how or why this helps us, but apparently it does. So without further ado, come on in, grab yourself a cup of coffee, and get ready for another episode of the Vet Tech Cafe.
Hello, Caffeinators. Welcome back to the Vet Tech Cafe, where your mental health is always on the menu. Of course, it's May. It's Mental Health Awareness Month, so our May episodes will be dedicated to mental health in our profession, and we've got a couple of great episodes on tap starting today that we think you'll really like. We'd like to thank all of our Caffeinators for your continued support. For our Patreons, we got a new Patreon recently, Kelly Cronin, who was a recent guest. Thank you so much. So thank you very much for your continued support to our Patreons and just continuing to download our episodes and subscribing to all of our channels. Special shout out to our Canadian Caffeinators. We love our neighbors to the north. And actually, both of our May episodes are going to be with Canadian guests.
So, oh, really? Cool. Okay.
If this is your first time to the Vet Tech Cafe, we're glad you're here. You can head over to vettechcafe.com for all of the info about Dave and I, who we are, why we do this, and then subscribe and like all of our channels, if you would, LinkedIn, Facebook, Instagram, and our YouTube channel as well. Dave, how's it going out there?
Well, we are recording on April 15th, so it's tax day.
You all
know that I hate finances. So I have been dealing with a 36-hour headache. But other than that, the weather's warming up, so that's a good thing. It's Jackie Robinson Day for those of you that follow baseball. But other than that, things are...
And it's Patriots Day and the Boston Marathon.
It's Patriots Day and the Boston Marathon. It's the winner already finished in 2:06. The Red Sox game is actually going on right now. I was watching that before we logged in. But things are good. It's a nice spring working its way into summer day. And we've got two episodes to record, so that's good. We haven't recorded in a while, so I'm happy to get back at it.
Yeah, definitely.
How are things out there? Everything, weather is absolutely picture perfect.
Well, it was late last week. We got cold and rain over the weekend, which was nice. But it's going to warm back up this week, so I can't complain about that. And you know, just thinking for a moment that you said the winner of the Boston Marathon finished in 2 hours and 6 minutes.
Yep.
Can you imagine running 26.2 miles in less time than it takes to play a baseball game?
I can't imagine it because I run half marathons and I can't do it in 2:06.
Yeah, that's the same. The one I did, I think, was 2:40 or 2:42, something like that, half marathon.
So my normal is anywhere between like 2:10 and 2:20. And the last one that I did, I struggled with it to the point where I was having that moment of like, I think I might be too old to do these anymore, because the last 4 miles was very, very hard. And it wasn't even a rough course. It's just there was something going on with my hips, and everyone asks me when I run these long races, like, oh, when are you going to do a full marathon? And I think about that up until the point where I get about 9 or 10 miles into a half marathon, and think to myself, do you want to do this again? Like right now? Yeah. And no, I do not have a full marathon in me.
No.
I'm starting to question if I have a half marathon left in me. So, but of course I'm stubborn, so I am going to do one, but
of course,
but a full marathon, not in the cards.
Yeah, not in the cards. I'm with you there. Well, let's go ahead and jump in. We've got an awesome episode here. Again, if you missed the intro, it's May 2024. So we always do mental health focused episodes for our May episodes. So first up, it's going to be Kathleen Dunbar. And Kathleen is a veterinary social worker with the Tender Tales program at Carnegie Animal Hospital Hospital in Halifax, Nova Scotia, Canada. Kathleen has a Master of Social Work and has worked in the mental health field for 25 years. Before becoming a social worker, she worked as a registered veterinary technician for a decade and a half and obtained her VTS, her veterinary technician specialty, in clinical practice and the canine feline subcategory of that in 2016, and has served as a contributing author to two veterinary technician textbooks, along with many other veterinary publications. She's dedicated to supporting grieving pet parents and veterinary team members who cope with the unique challenges of the industry. She's particularly interested in death, grief, and end-of-life support. And Kathleen provides individual and group counseling to pet parents and veterinary team members on the East Coast of Canada. So, Kathleen, first off, thank you so much for taking some time out to meet with us today. These are always very important episodes for us. So thank you so much. What can we get you for a cup of coffee?
I'll have a medium roast with one cream. That would be fantastic. Thank
you. All right.
Yeah. Maybe a large if possible.
Absolutely. Not a problem at all. If you wouldn't mind, take us through your career path, kind of what got you into veterinary medicine, some stops along the way, and what you're doing now, and we'll go from there.
Yeah, that's a great question. It's kind of long and windy, honestly. It started probably, I would say, 1995, I obtained my bachelor's degree in sociology. And not long after that, I started working in housing for people with mental health concerns. So, did that for a number of years. I actually still occasionally pop in and do the odd overnight. I've known a lot of those clients for a lot of years. So, you know, they have a special place in my heart. I would say, let me see, in 2006, I went back and obtained my diploma in vet technology at a local college here. And I always kind of was drawn to animals, you know, like a lot of us, it's a love for animals, a love for science. And then, you know, I kind of felt like I worked in the industry a long time. I was very lucky to have an extremely supportive employer and boss who always were supporting me and advancing my skills, you know, encouraging me to do things like intubating upside down or intubating sideways, putting catheters in unique places and pulling blood from unique places. So then I went on and obtained my clinical practice specialty in 2016. And then did some speaking and was, you know, filling my boots a little bit with that new accomplishment, but always feeling like, honestly, the needs of the industry weren't getting met. I constantly felt like in veterinary medicine, I kept noticing staff, team members in distress, but also pet parents leaving and grieving and not really getting the support that I wish they had had. So, and it kind of reached a peak. I actually did a keynote speech for my local association and it was on mental health in the industry. And at that time I just happened to look up to see if I had the prerequisites to go back to school to do social work. And sure enough, I did. And, luckily, there's someone locally who studies the human-animal bond as well. So I was very fortunate. And then I went back to school around the time of COVID and completed that in 2022. So I've been working for close to 2 years now as a vet social worker. So that's the kind of long and windy version of it. Yeah.
Yeah. No, that's amazing. So when you initially graduated with your degree in sociology, was social work kind of your path? And were you working at a clinic at that time? Like, how did those two kind of come together?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. I started working at a vet hospital in 2008. So I became an RVT around that time. And in terms of what I did after my sociology degree, it was completely supportive housing for people with mental health problems. But it's almost like they intersected, I found, because we had a therapy cat in the group home. So I would be, you know, monitoring that cat, ensuring he, you know, we, of course, you know, like any RVT, we're surrounded by animals who have needs. So he had IBD. And so just sourcing out, you know, Royal Canin for a proper diet for him and getting sponsorship and kind of doing sort of a bit of social work-ish type duties. And then all the while working at the clinic and just, I always loved those clients who were in distress. I was constantly drawn to the client communication and kind of problem solving aspects of the industry. So that's it. They kind of intersected along the way, I found a lot.
Well, and also thinking like the cat, that's a form of mental health help too,
yeah,
right?
Absolutely.
The bond that they would have with that cat. I think that's important too. And, you know, I think that a lot of those types of group homes, like if they had pets, you know, that were there, I think that would help out a lot. I mean,
absolutely.
If for nothing else, just to get people to come in, you know, cause a lot of times with, mm-hmm, with those types of shelters, they're not, I don't want to speak out of turn, but it seems like sometimes it's a struggle to get people to come in when they really should be going in. But if
absolutely,
there was a cat there that I could hang out with, or a dog I could hang out with, I mean, that would be a big draw, I think, to get people to go there.
Yeah, it was amazing the bond that, specifically with one of the clients in the house, he played the guitar, and the cat was very scared when he first moved in, but he played the guitar and managed to draw the cat out from under the coat with music, and then they formed a special bond over
That's
it.
Really
so
cool.
Yeah, absolutely.
Another follow-up I have is, you went through the process of getting your RVT and getting your VTS. Do you still do some of the technician work, or are you more focused on the social work now?
I'm more focused on social work, but I am very fortunate that my local, the Nova Scotia Vet Medical Association, allows me to keep up with my RVT credentials through doing pet loss support. So I do have a vet who I consult with on specific cases. It's not so much the counseling end of it. It's more the quality of life and decision making, mm-hmm, end of it. And I follow up with a vet. We do case consults, and then so it's kind of a unique, mm-hmm, you know, integrating the two of them sometimes. So I am able to keep up with that. And of course I do my continuing education and attending conferences and so on.
Yeah. You got to do that to keep up with the credentials.
Exactly.
So let's talk about we always like to ask our guests about the vet tech profession itself. Someone who's been in it and now kind of, I don't want to say you're on the outside looking in, but you're kind of adjacent to it now. How do you view the profession that we have? How do you, like, are there things that we still need to work on? Are there things that we're doing right? And specifically kind of in your area, because, you know, we're US guys and you're in Canada.
Mm-hmm. No, that's a great question. And I feel like we're kind of at a turning point. I believe personally in the industry where we're kind of at a fork in the road where, honestly, I feel like we need to think outside the box a little bit, color outside the lines, and consider what currently is our scope of practice. And I'm going to push the lines a bit and honestly say that I think it's possible for RVTs or any credentialed vet tech with advanced training like a VTS to actually prescribe medications within reason. And I know we really need to reimagine things, and that might ruffle some feathers, but I think certain things like antiparasitics or insulin or antibiotics, I think there's no reason why with the proper training and the proper credentialing that RVTs who have that level of experience and, you know, perhaps if you're a VTS and you have that special training, I think that's because I think it would add to the retention and lower the attrition rates of credentialed vet techs for sure, because right now the vet industry is in crisis. We're seeing tons of of turnover, and we're seeing significant mental health distress and burnout in the industry. So I really believe, and not that that will completely solve it, but it can certainly be rejuvenating if an RVT or a VTS has, you know, the ability to have more decision-making ability, because it's been proven that lower decision-making ability is equates to more moral distress. So if we can mitigate that some, I think that would be, it's a great opportunity for sure.
Yeah, you're slowly nudging us towards the mid-level practitioner discussion, which we've had on the show many times. And that's kind of the thing where, yes, if we can have that mid-level practitioner and have credentialed technicians and VTSs in that role, like, I'm all for it. But I also think that there's a lot of other things that need to get fixed before we start to make that a role. That is a thing that will definitely keep people in the profession. It is more responsibility, more respect, I guess.
Yeah, definitely.
And anything we can do to keep people in the profession, I think is a good thing.
Yeah. And I think that's really important. And in terms of sort of, if I veer to the mental health area of things, I can't help but think, I have, and this is not evidence-based by any means, but I have this, I know that from research out there indicates that people who are drawn to animals actually when they're children actually have significant histories of trauma. And so I can't help but, I have this little speculation, it's not evidence-based, but I can't help but wonder if people are walking around, if they're drawn to animals and they have the trauma, so they go into the industry with trauma, and then if they have that trauma and then they're mentally distressed and then they're set up in a hospital that, you know, is not super supportive, then we're really setting people up for failure. So it's
a profession that attracts people that are traumatized, and then we wonder why they're traumatized.
That's a great way to say it. Yeah. And I just want to point out that my whole theory on that is not evidence-based by any means, but it's something I've thought about just from supporting. I support a lot of vet team members through counseling and therapy, and I really do see a lot of them have backgrounds where of trauma. So I cannot but wonder if there's something to that.
I hadn't heard that before, but that's I mean, it makes sense. It's logical.
Absolutely. So your work now as a veterinary social worker, so what kind of drew you to like transition out of clinical practice to that role? Is it like a something where, you know, need and opportunity intersect? Obviously you have a little bit of a social work type of background, so like, did you identify that there's a need there and you just said, actually this is something I could do? Like, what kind of led you to go down that path?
And you know, I do get asked that question, and I have to say it started with the intersection of, I was constantly working, you know, doing the work in the mental health industry, all the while I was doing the work, the RVT work. So, and it was a bit of sort of almost manifesting a bit of my wish, which was, I felt like the hospital where I was working needed a social worker. I felt like there needed to be that put in place. I feel very fortunate that I've been very fortunate with my employers, where I've had, you know, very supportive people around me. And it literally, the vet social work employment kind of happened incidentally one day, where I was talking with my manager after I had graduated, and I was working an RVT shift there. And she said, well, why don't we just bring you on as a social worker here? And so it just kind of happened. I don't know if it's atypical, but I feel like it might be, not every vet hospital out there would be as welcoming, but I was very fortunate to have that. So
That's a wild thing to think about, that your hospital is just like, yeah, let's just,
yeah, kudos,
let's
to just that
hire,
manager
hire a social, like, worker, and it's you. Yeah. You know, that's crazy that they just decided to make that role. And, you know, usually things like that are, especially if it's a corporate practice, decisions like that are long and involved, and probably take years to actually come to fruition. I think that's amazing that they just said, you know what, this is what we need to do, and here's the perfect person to do it. I love that they said that for you. So let's talk about the process of education and credentialing to become a social worker. What did that entail? Obviously, you said that you had your previous degree that helped out with that, but how did you actually go down that path? Like, did you just look it up and say, hey, I want to be a social worker. How do I do this? Or how does that work?
Yeah, that's it. You know, what I did was I remember I was sitting at home in my pajamas, and I literally Googled veterinary and social work, and I found that it was a thing. So I that's what it did. So I Googled it, and I was like, that's what I want to do. And I had always thought that there needed to be some kind of a place at a vet hospital, you know, sort of a more interdisciplinary place for someone who could be there to help the clients and the staff. And I did that. And then I found out because I didn't have an actual undergraduate degree in social work, it was in sociology, I needed to apply to the 2-year Masters of Social Work program. So if I had had like a Bachelor of Social Work, it would have been 1 year, but it was gotcha. 2 years. So I had to do like a foundation year. And then I graduated, and in the province where I live, like it varies by state and province, but in the province where I live in Nova Scotia, it's actually a candidacy process. So I work with a mentor, and even though I can call myself a veterinary social worker now, I still technically am a candidate through the regulatory body, and I'm at the final stages of that. So,
Gotcha. You had said in your previous answer, I think you said something about, you know, not knowing how common it was. And we had, when I worked at Tufts University, we had a social worker, a veterinary social worker on staff, and he's actually been a guest on our podcast. His name's Aaron Bridgman.
Yeah. It's been a while. Yeah.
And my hope is that, like, he was, I will say, at least when I was there, his role was geared more towards pet parents. Not quite as much with the staff, but I think that was kind of evolving a little bit more into that realm as well, kind of towards the end of my time there. And hearing your answer there, I hope that certainly the graduates from that university now are going to be used to interacting with a veterinary social worker, and maybe can see the benefits of it as they go out into practice. And I'm hoping that becomes, you know, more common across vet schools, where they have one on staff, and it's just another role in the clinic where, you know, you have this person, because truly we're not really trained on end of life care or support for the parents or the owners or what have you. And it's such a valuable role that I hope 10 years down the road, 20 years down the road, that it's just more common because more graduates are out in practice that have been around somebody that's performed that role or while they were in school performed that role, and they could see the benefits from it. So I don't know. One of those things that I hope someday is better than
I hope
is
so
now.
Too.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so looking at your role now in that hospital, like how do you apply your role either to the staff members or to the pet parents? Like, what does that look like?
Yeah. So in terms of the staff members, I have a specific space in the hospital. It's called the Tender Tail space. And it's kind of off to the side. So it's if people want a bit of privacy, a staff member, if they want to come, sometimes I have staff members, honestly, who just come in my room and just take some deep breaths and leave. Like, they just need space to decompress. Other times they might be in distress and need someone to talk to. I've had every member every team member from various roles to come in and chat with me at some point or another. Not every person, but it ranges, you know, vets, RVTs, vet assistants, receptionists, anyone will come in. And we also actually, the Tendertails is essentially a hub for the East Coast of Canada. So we accept referrals from all over the East Coast. I have entitlements in all the Atlantic provinces. So we accept referrals. And that's when I actually do the individual counseling, the therapy with those particular team members. I don't actually do therapy with the team members who I work with at the hospital. It's kind of, I feel like it's crossing a boundary a little bit because I see them in the hallway and some of them I've actually known for many years as well. So it's more, that's where the referrals come in, and I refer them to for external support if they need it. But I certainly do act in an informal way with them in the hospital if they need support.
Is that because there's like in therapy, there needs to be like somewhat of a disconnect, and you're not necessarily like an outside source, and you're not necessarily an outside source?
Yeah. So I will act informally in a way and offer them support, but I don't actually do individual counseling for, I have done it in the past, I'll be honest with you, but I haven't, it's not something that we do anymore. It's based on referral, and they seek someone else for support. So.
Gotcha. And you said for the Atlantic provinces, are you aware of anything similar to what you're doing in the central provinces or in the Pacific provinces? Like, are you able to network with any other veterinary social workers across Canada or anything like that?
Yeah. There are a few of us. I think there may be like five or six across Canada of vet social workers. And we have like an informal network where that just started really recently, where we're meeting to discuss, you know, review cases and talk about how to best support each other. There's been talk about developing an association, like a national association, but that hasn't come to be yet. There is the International Association of Vet Social Work, and that's based out of the U.S. in Tennessee. And like I'm a member of that, and I think a lot of my Canadian colleagues are members of that as well.
Yeah, I think the University of Tennessee Vet School, I think that's where Eric Richmond, who the social worker that's at Tufts, I think that's where he did his program, and I think one or two other people I talked to. So
okay,
and I think that's how that's connected. But again, that's another vet school that like has this program and has somebody on staff that does that. And hopefully, again, just more and more and more, you know, it just trends in that direction.
Yeah.
And my thought process is like, my gears are always working with stuff like this. I'm like, I wonder if this is something that could be made into yet another VTS.
Because it
is veterinary related.
Definitely.
But I would imagine that there's not, to do that, you'd have to be an RVT or licensed tech and a social worker, which I don't think there's many of them.
Yeah.
Correct me if I'm wrong. You're the one that I know of that is both.
There are a couple more in North America, not in Canada, to my knowledge, but there are, their names offhand, it's not coming to me, but there are a couple kicking around. But it's funny, Dave, you would say that because I've actually had the same. I'm wondering if this could be a VTS, I think there might be space for that for sure.
Yeah. Well, and when we talked to Eric, Eric was not a technician.
He was just
a social worker, right?
Yeah. He only was social work was his primary.
Well, before we get into our next group of questions here, why don't we take our little break here and we'll pay some bills and we'll be back after the break.
The Vet Tech Cafe is sponsored by BetterHelp. Caffeinators, at the Vet Tech Cafe, you know we like to focus on mental health. If you're struggling with depression, burnout, compassion fatigue, or any of the other mental health challenges we discuss on our podcast, getting professional help is a great first step.
We all need help with things like learning positive coping skills and how to set boundaries, which empowers you to be the best version of yourself. It isn't just for those who've experienced major mental health challenges.
If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. Dave, I've used BetterHelp. I had really good success with it. I really like that it was entirely online. It's designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. You just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist. You can also switch therapists at any time for no additional cost.
You can log into your account anytime and send a message to your therapist, and you'll get timely and thoughtful responses. Plus, you can schedule weekly video or phone sessions. They really make it easy for you to get the help you need.
Discover your potential with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/vettechcafe today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/vettechcafe. It's time to invest in yourself. Be well, caffeinators.
All right, welcome back to the Vet Tech Cafe, everybody, where we are creating yet another VTS, TBD, if we can get Kathleen to start it up. So Kathleen, we had our ad for BetterHelp, and since this is Mental Health Awareness Month, give us some insight on how you manage your own mental health. I imagine that's kind of hard when you're dealing with mental health issues throughout your work and also having to deal with your own. How do you manage your own mental health?
Yeah, it's constant monitoring, honestly. It's always, you know, making sure that every day is about monitoring, I find, because in supporting people who are in distress, it's quite easy, I think, similar to the veterinary industry, to take on someone else's distress. So I see a therapist. I see one twice a month. And I practice mindfulness. I'm fortunate. I was trained in that. I lived in British Columbia in the mid 90s. So I actually British Columbia is kind of like the California of Canada. So we were kind of ahead of the game. So I was trained in that in the mid 90s. So I think in order to teach things to my clients, it's good to be familiar. You know, I can't imagine teaching mindfulness to someone if you've never done it yourself. So I work at living in the present moment as much as possible. Sometimes that can be tricky, but that's when in breath work and emotional regulation and things like that. So
yeah, it's you just kind of hit a note with me, the constant monitoring thing. That makes sense, is that it's not a set and forget thing.
No.
Cause I give a talk on work life balance, and the first thing that I tell people is that I don't have all the answers, and
no,
it's not something where your work life balance is going to be 50-50 every day. Some days it's 70-30, some days it's 60-40, some days it's 50-50. So it's a constantly changing thing. And I think that's probably the same with mental health, is that you're constantly trying to monitor it and making sure that you're staying within that range of what's normal for you, I guess.
Absolutely.
That's an interesting way of putting it. It's not something that you can just check off a box and say, I've done my mental health for the day.
No. It's kind of like a set of stairs. I tell my clients, like, mental health, you know, you'd like to think you're sort of near the bottom of the steps, and you know, but you know, if there's a stressor, you might closely creep up the steps, but ideally we're not at the very top, where we're in significant distress, because especially working in the veterinary industry, we don't know what's coming our way. Sometimes there's that level of unpredictability, which can lead to significant distress. So
It's like me with my taxes. Like, I've been hovering at the bottom of the stairs, knowing that staircase is way up here, and I've just been waiting at the bottom until I absolutely have to go up the stairs.
No fun, taxes.
No, it's the worst.
Yeah.
So just thinking about your role as the social worker, how has that been received by your colleagues? Like, how has that benefited them? Obviously, you said you weren't like consulting with them, but how has it benefited like your doctors when you have a client that needs some counseling? How has that helped out?
It's in terms of how it's helping out the doctors. It's always been well received. The doctors will come to me with cases. A lot of times they're frequently, it's those end of life cases where people are just struggling with making decisions. So it's around decision making and quality of life. Also, I do notice, especially with since COVID, we have these cats and dogs sometimes that have behavioral issues, and people are struggling with they're having significant distress with their dogs, and they're, they might be showing some aggression. So it's like, where do they go? So I actually support anyone who has anything to do with the human animal bond. Sometimes it can be people who, because, when you have patients or pets in your home and they're having, problems with aggression or so on, it can be distressing as well. So, and it's been well received by everyone. Ironically, the only people who interestingly have been less welcoming actually are social workers. I find sometimes they're a little baffled by it. I've encountered a couple, and it's not that have been rude about it, but they've been a little, and I think it's just a lack of understanding about the veterinary industry. They just don't understand why the veterinary industry would need a social worker.
That's good to hear, because I feel like in our profession, I could see how there would be a lot of hesitation by veterinary staff to utilize that kind of resource, or I feel like, especially some of the old timers like Dave and I, I worry we're too far gone, but we're too jaded, or it's not for me, or it's nice to hear that people are open to that idea in our field, because I don't know, my mind tells me that there's a segment of our colleagues that would be completely disinterested in that, or maybe not even trusting of it. I don't know. Maybe it goes back to
seeing the value in it.
That trauma, yeah. you know, the previous trauma you were alluding to earlier, who knows, probably another multifactorial problem, but I just could see how some people would be like, why do we need this? So it's good to hear that it's pretty well received.
It has been, definitely. Yeah. I have never run into anyone so far who said, I don't see the need for this. So it's been very well received and well used as well. So good.
For me, I would be like, this owner can't make a decision. Somebody else needs to deal with this. And I would say, Kathleen, you deal with this. I would love having that in a hospital that I was working at, to not have to deal with emotions and deal with upset owners and all that stuff. I would love to pass that off to somebody else.
Sure. So your role with pet owners, you've mentioned a couple of times you'll do consultations with veterinarians and things. So I'm curious how that gets set up. Do you consult with any pet parent that's euthanizing their pet? Like if they need help, or does a doctor kind of suss that out and say, hey, I think this person may need some extra help. And they say, hey, we're going to have somebody contact you. Or like, what does that process look like? And what do you provide for pet owners?
Yeah, so it's by referral from one of the vets in the practice, or it can be from anyone in the practice who feels that someone might need some extra support. So certainly there is the decision making and quality of life, and then what happens after is I do individual counseling for pet parents when they're grieving, and I also offer a group. So I have a pet loss group where it's an 8-week group.
Okay.
Yeah. And it is by referral, but people can self-refer as well. Sure. So if they want that. Yeah.
Okay. And so some of your consultations or some of your work may be starting with end of life and quality of life type discussions, but some also may just be after the fact and, correct, like kind of all across that spectrum.
Yeah, it's pretty broad. It can start with, anticipatory grief where they're, you know, or, you know, because I'm sure everyone who's listening has that sense of those clients who are engaging in significant caretaking duties with their pets. You know, they're staying up. They've got their Excel spreadsheets. They're staying up all night, you know, yeah, with their companion animals, and they're anticipating the death. But then it can move on to, you know, quality of life, decision making, post loss counseling, and also groups. And I do as well check on the pet parents a few days after they've lost the death of their companion animal, and then I check on them regularly after that as well. And that's for any client of the hospital where I work.
I'm curious how the referrals work. Like, how you said that there's sometimes referrals from other hospitals. How does that work? Do they know about you? Do you advertise for that, or how does that come into your hospital, and how does that logistically work out?
Don't advertise as well as we should, but I have brochures and we're working on a web page, which hasn't, but right now I get a lot through Facebook and Instagram, as well as, you know, an individual hospital may call and say, we've got this client, what's the best way to reach you? So, yeah.
So you are a known entity throughout your area, pretty much.
We are. Yeah. It is known.
And did your hospital have support for you in this role, or did it take some convincing, or how did that? I know you said that they wanted to do that, but was it just that easy?
It literally was that easy. Like it was, I remember I was just sitting there, you know, finishing up a phone call. My hospital manager came up to me and said, like, why don't we take you on? And we are corporate. So somehow she managed to, talk to whoever. And,
wow.
And then it started, it just kind of, and it, we keep growing, actually. It's, it started just being a little bit informal, but then we developed the Tender Tales program, and, I got a larger space, and, there's definitely a need. Yeah,
absolutely. I'm curious, have you done any training for staff? Maybe how to recognize those pet owners that maybe need some help or someone to talk to, or like, you know, I imagine the introverts that we largely are, like, I'm sure some people are good at recognizing that, some people maybe not as much. So I'm curious, have you done any of that, or with the veterinarians, to be like, these are things to look for, or these are situations to reach out to me, or like, how have you kind of recruited their help in identifying those people that need help?
Yeah, we actually, what we ended up doing was, and which I've been encouraging all vet hospitals to do, and your listeners might be interested in this, but what we do is we actually have a care package that goes out to every pet parent after the death of their pet. And the bag of the care package leaves with that client. And in it is a brochure. 'Cause so often, you know, pet parents, they don't know how they're going to feel down the road. You don't know if they're going to really be struggling. So sometimes it's really challenging to tell who's going to be struggling the most. So we have a care package, and in that care package are some resources, the brochure, like some memorial items and things like that. So we kind of take that approach to it. And because as you know, many people are aware, we kind of, so often people don't know how they're going to feel after the death of their companion animal, and they may not look at it for 5 days, you know, down the road. So it's just helpful to kind of take a more of a blanket approach. But I certainly am, the veterinary team members, whether the vets or any staff member, sometimes will come to me and say, can you check on so-and-so again today because they were in to pick up a prescription for their other pet and they don't look like themselves or things like that. Yeah.
Wow.
And tell us a little bit about the Tender Tales program. What I mean, obviously you mentioned the care packages, but what else is involved? Like, is there like a, as technicians, we're always like, oh, what's the protocol? What are the SOPs? Is there like a protocol, or is it kind of very case by case basis? I would imagine it's more case by case basis, right?
It is case by case, yeah. But certainly, I'm actually in the beginning stages of developing policies for the program. Okay. So you can imagine it's like a fun activity. You think taxes are bad, but policy developments.
I tell you want to trade. I will do your SOPs. I will do your protocols.
Yeah. Because we realize that we need those, right? Yeah, mm-hmm. Just like taxes, yeah. you need SOPs. So I'm working on that right now, and I'm only on policy 2. It's a long haul. Yeah. But that's an excellent question. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Thinking about, like, I'm sure in your position, it feels like changes. Slow in this area, or we're slow to adapt or to kind of utilize this more regularly. But thinking even back probably 5 years ago, until Eric started at Tufts, I don't think I'd ever heard of the idea of a veterinary social worker. And I'm curious in this short period of time how you've seen it evolve, and maybe what you see changing, or what you would like to see change, how it changes over the next few years, 10 years, whatever it might be. Like, how has it come this far in this short period of time, and where do you see it going?
I see, like, since I was put in this role locally, there was another hospital in Prince Edward Island. They have put in at the vet college there a social worker. So I see it's increasing. I personally would love to see a vet social worker at every animal hospital. I know that's a little bit of a high kind of demand, but I really feel like even if it's one social worker shared amongst hospitals, I feel like there's potential for that. And I see it's an emerging field, but I think with more understanding and appreciation of the issues, I think we're going to see lots of growth. There's lots of potential. And I feel like the veterinary industry has been largely, you know, unidisciplinary. I don't even know if that's a word, but, you know, it's we haven't been multidisciplinary. So we need to look at expanding and thinking, you know, thinking in an innovative way that maybe social workers are really helpful to have on staff. And since there is definitely, you know, there's a need in my hospital, I can't imagine thinking that there wouldn't be a need at many hospitals. So,
yeah, I think that's such a great point. Like, I'm sure, like, not every hospital out there has the demand or the need, like, or the clientele that would need their own social worker, but that idea of one, you know, contracted with a couple of dozen hospitals, or, you know, some hospitals in an area, and that they can just refer people to as they need, like, there absolutely is ways to do that and share that resource, as opposed to, like, you know, well, we just, you know, our volume isn't high enough to warrant that. Well, if you have one client that you wish you could have see a social worker, you have the need, right? I mean, mm-hmm. Or you have one client that you think would benefit from that, you have the need. Like, you can
definitely,
multiple places around you also have that same need.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. There's definitely lots of potential. And I almost see like a satellite type system set up, like something where there's a hub and mm-hmm. Yeah.
So as we're getting towards the end of our hour here, I'm going to give you the opportunity to try and recruit people. Like, how what's your pitch to get people to do this role?
That's a great question, actually. Mm. I would say, first of all, it involves a lot of creativity. And I, you know, it's an emerging field, so you can have a lot of fun just navigating your own path. So anyone out there who loves to do creative things, who loves, who when they were doing RVT work, they loved sort of the communication end of things, or I was always the kind of person who loved solving problems or looking for resources as an RVT. So anyone out there who does things like that, you're using those skills, and it's a lot of fun. And you can also feel like you're making a difference in someone's life as well.
And if they want to do that, where would you recommend they start? Like what, like say somebody came to you and said, "Hey, I'm looking at doing what you're doing." You would say, start here. Where is that?
Yeah, I would start reaching out to local colleges or universities just to see what they offer for programs, see if you have the prerequisites. And if you don't have the prerequisites, there are ways around that. There are, you know, maybe do some additional schooling if you need to. I went back to school when I was in my late 40s, so I'm 52 now, and you can do things at any age, so there's always room for that.
And there's not a veterinary social work degree program, right? It's you go into social work and then you apply it to the veterinary field. Is that correct?
Actually, in Tennessee, I believe it's the University of Tennessee. Oh, okay. They do have a vet social work program.
Excellent.
You don't actually have to take that. You can. Veterinary social work is kind of like similar to if you were to say you were like a hospital social worker, or more of an adjective. It's not really a specialty. So anyone right now who's working as a social worker can, you know, dive into vet social work or. You definitely don't have to attend. Although I hear wonderful things about the program, but you don't have to attend that program.
Okay. And so as we're starting to wrap up, is there anything that we haven't talked about today that you want to get out to our listeners?
I think the only thing I would say is that I feel like veterinary medicine, the veterinary industry, sometimes is afraid of embracing a bit of change and looking at new models for the